Φωνοκινέσεις.
Pues muy buenos días, buenas tardes y buenas noches a todos los que nos acompañan aquí en este episodio Fonoquinesis. Y bueno, este episodio es un episodio muy especial. Yo creo que es el episodio más especial que hemos hecho. Y voy a dejar que mi compañero aquí, el buen Francisco de León, nos explique por qué es tan especial este episodio.
Bueno, pues tenemos un invitado muy especial. Tenemos aquí a Jared Bauer, que es una persona dedicada a la filosofía, pero que también ha creado una cantidad de videos bastante importantes. Él es co-creador de un canal de YouTube que se llama Wisecrack. Ahora ha dejado este proyecto y está comenzando un proyecto propio, ¿no? En el cual hace análisis de películas, de distintos productos culturales. Hace un par de días subió un episodio analizando el último especial de Dave Chappelle, ¿no? Y bueno, tiene ahí varios temas muy interesantes. Y justamente, ¿no? Muchos de los videos que Jared ha realizado a lo largo de los últimos años sirvieron mucho de inspiración para cosas que hacíamos Sergio y yo aquí en Fonoquinesis, ¿no? Era un referente obligado, en especial los que hacía él, ¿no? Todo el equipo es muy interesante, pero en especial los que hacía Jared, como que había una sintonía bastante especial, ¿no? Pero bueno, obviamente él está ahora en Helsinki, pues si mal no recuerdo, está en Helsinki, pero entonces haremos la entrevista obviamente en inglés, ¿no? Entonces yes. A partir de ahora tendremos que cambiar un poquito el idioma, no se preocupen, bueno, aquí Sergio nos va a comentar cómo vamos a llevar la dinámica, ¿no?
Sí, así es, vamos a pasar al idioma inglés, pero no se preocupen que van a poder ver este episodio con subtítulos. Si quieren seguir el episodio, los subtítulos estarán en YouTube y podrán ver el episodio en YouTube con subtítulos. Así que, sin más preámbulos, hi Jared, how are you?
Lo siento, yo hablo español no bueno.
No worries.
No worries.
I understand, I think, everything you guys said. You know, I took like 3 years of Spanish in high school.
Great.
And, you know, I'm from Texas, so I speak Texas Spanglish. But I'm much better at understanding than I am speaking. But yeah, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, of course. Thank you. Thank you for coming. We're really honored to have you here. It's really interesting for us. Essentially, our podcast has always been the relationship between philosophy, music, and cinema. Essentially, because I'm a musician, Francisco is a philosopher, and we both love cinema. So we're really honored to have you here. And we want to start talking about who is Jared Bauer. I want you to tell our audience. Who are you? Where did you grow up? When did you got that interested in philosophy and cinema?
I'm glad you asked the follow-up questions, because if you just asked me who is Jared Bauer, I think I'd have a small existential crisis. In Houston, Texas, I'm the child of two New York Jews who got tired of New York and decided to move to Texas to start a family. My household was very culturally kind of Northeastern America, United States of America. And I always was really enamored by entertainment, specifically movies. And so from a very young age, I knew I wanted to go into entertainment. At first, I wanted to be an actor, but then around middle school time, I realized I wasn't any good at it. So then I kind of wanted to be a filmmaker. And so I went to film school at the University of Texas at Austin. And then I moved to Los Angeles to kind of pursue the dream. And then, gosh, man, I tell you, so much has changed in the film industry in terms of the way the business works. And even so much had changed from the time that I entered film school in 2006 to when I graduated in 2010. I mean, it was a totally different world. Yeah. And now it's an even more different world. Mm. And long story short, it was an interesting time to be entering the independent film landscape, because basically it was no longer a business anymore. You know, and so I ended up experimenting on YouTube and kind of found a voice doing something that I was passionate about, which was humanities education, because I thought and continue to think it's very worthwhile. And so my business partner and I started a company called Wisecrack, built it for 8 years, sold the company in 2019. It was a very crazy journey of high highs and low lows and tons of stress. And I had to end up leaving Los Angeles because it just wasn't really, there were a lot of things that I did not like about my life there. And I took an opportunity to move to Finland. And so now that's where I live now. And as far as my new efforts on YouTube, my number one goal above all else is authenticity, because I think that performative elements of our lives are omnipresent. And I really want to draw attention to them because I think that it's not something that's reflected on enough.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. I think at least for us in our podcast, we are always looking to shed the light, especially on the kind of cinema that you don't see every day, and to like be a platform for authenticity, not just for us, but also for our audience, to like really share, you know, what they like, what they find interesting. And sometimes that is maybe not something that you will see on a bigger platform, but it's definitely really something that will that is worthwhile, you know, seeing and watching. And I think that happens a lot with art. And it's really interesting that you talk about moving to Europe, because Francisco and I were both Mexican, but we both live in Europe, so we both understand what it is to do that kind of life change and really look for or other opportunities, or having like a certain lifestyle, right? Because sometimes in your life you feel like that is your life, that like that's gonna be your life, and some moments in your life, and then everything changes, and then you start to think, oh, okay, I can be something, someone else. I can really rethink about my life. So it's really interesting to hear your life story, and I'm really hopeful for the new journey that is ahead of you.
Thank you. Yeah, I think change of environment is so important and so powerful. And you know, it sounds like bullshit, right? But it's not.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. I would like to start with, well, you made a video about it and we can see your on a wall behind you. But precisely, we would like to talk a little bit more about your influences, who are your favorite philosophers or filmmakers, and how have they changed your point of view of the world?
Mm. Okay, so which one do you want to start with? I feel like I could speak for 2 hours about that.
Yeah. we can have a top three. Like we can go top three, maybe filmmakers, top three philosophers, and then we can develop it a little bit around that.
Oh, man. All right. Well, top three philosophers, just in terms of, I guess, how they inform my worldview, I would say are probably Sartre, and I'll go ahead and put Dostoevsky in there as a philosopher, although perhaps not one you would learn in school under that guise. So I'd say Sartre, Dostoevsky, and oh man, thinking of a third one is hard. I apologize. I should have just like an answer really quick off the top of my head.
No, that's okay. It's okay.
And I only picked two because I feel like the third one, I don't know. I mean, maybe. All right, let's move on to filmmakers. Filmmakers, I really like David Cronenberg, David Lynch, and maybe Nicholas Roeg. I mean, those are just three that I love. But I mean, picking a top three is impossible. I mean, I didn't even say Kubrick, and that's absurd. So Kubrick is definitely one of them.
But we don't mention Kubrick because, you know, Kubrick is like, we all know he's one of the greatest. So it's kind of like a given, you know?
Yeah, he's the one. And yeah, was there anything else? Philosophers, movies, musicians? I'm really not that, probably not as educated about music as you guys. It's always been kind of a blind spot for me.
It's all good.
It's good. But you were talking about Beethoven in your video. I remember that.
Yeah,
we have Beethoven and Mozart over there, so
I have family members that live in Salzburg, Austria, the birthplace of Mozart. All they ever talk about is Mozart in that town.
Of course.
Yeah. It's a good marketing tool.
It could be interesting to talk about how you feel literature and philosophy and cinema can mix. You know, Gildeleuze used to talk about this kind of marriage between film and philosophy, because how films can portray very important ideas in the history of thought. So,
I would say that cinema, and I don't know if this really overlaps with what Deleuze was saying. I have not read what you're referring to, but I remember Austin, I don't know if you listened to our movie podcast, but Austin told me all about that one time because he's really into Deleuze. But anyway, I think that there's this great movie by Powell and Pressburger called Peeping Tom. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but you know, it's similar to the man with the moving camera, the Vertov movie. It really is an interesting exemplification of how the camera is kind of like a voyeur. You know, it is kind of this this first person perspective, and I think potentially a first person perspective, but whether or not it's actually like a third person point of view that the camera's presenting, what's really important here is the term perspective. I think, of course, perspective can be communicated in books as well, and I would, you know, basically say the same about literature that I'm saying about film, but film has a really powerful way because there are so many tools at an artist's disposal. You know, for example, I believe that film is actually much more powerful than a stage play, although they operate at different wavelengths. But for one thing, like film, unlike stage, has the power of juxtaposition, which is just like a way that you can show one visual image and then juxtapose it with another visual image in an entirely different time, place, setting, visual style. And, you know, that juxtaposition can, if you want to say dialectically, make some sort of point or provide some kind of an insight. And so all these things, all these tools that cinema offers, because cinema isn't just image, it's also the moving image. It's not just sound, it's also music. It's also sound design. These tools are all so potent that a film really has an amazing ability to craft not only a message. I mean, yes, a message, but also kind of subsume someone in a perspective that they may never have considered before. And so I think that film is a very powerful thing to awaken people, you know, which is why I think The Matrix or even Inception are kind of like good literal plots that can kind of describe the effect of really exploring world cinema, because it can really not only specific points of view, but specific cultures, specific ideas. It's just so powerful of a communication tool.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I think especially when you're developing like abstract concepts, I think cinema is really, really good at that. And especially, I think that's why philosophy works so well with cinema, at least in my opinion. Sometimes in philosophy, you have a lot of abstract ideas that are sometimes hard to land or to develop. And I think that's why, for example, Dostoevsky is so powerful, because he can really relate really deep concepts of philosophy and thought into ideas that are a little bit more down to earth, you know. And I think for me, at least as a music producer, sometimes music is really abstract in some ways, and sometimes it's just hard to express some concepts or some ideas, some experiences. And I think with cinema, it's just like you said, you have so much cooperation in between forms of art, you know, music, sound, image, and then it just blends all together. And I think that really works when you're trying to really land abstract concepts or like abstract ideas. And it really works to help people understand things that maybe you will not understand if you're reading a book or listening to a record. And I think that it just brings everything together.
Yeah, and I think the other obvious thing is that a movie has an ending, unlike a television show necessarily. And so something just has to happen. And oftentimes when, you know, the story reaches a conclusion, it's likely that there will be some kind of, you know, something, some kind of force, whether it's an emotional force, an ideological force, allows us to get to that resolution. And so that's where kind of something like an ideology can be more present in a movie than necessarily a television show, because if there is some desirable equilibrium at the end that is achieved, then, you know, some sort of value statement is often made, if that makes sense.
Yeah, completely makes sense.
I would like to talk a little bit about, for example, in my case, I grew up, my father was a movie projectionist. He used to work in the cinema.
Oh, nice.
And yeah, it was really nice because I grew up in a cinema.
In the booth? So,
yeah, in the booth.
He used to work in the
booth. Yeah, that was awesome. But for me, it was a mixture of living between Hollywood films, because they were very popular in Mexico, and you mostly have films produced in the U.S., but suddenly they changed my father to a more artsy cinema. So I engaged with David Lynch, and I remember Wim Wenders. I watched Wings of Desire being very young. So I really relate to your Weisskrug videos, because you were working with big cinema or artsy cinema and more entertainment cinema and movie business. You know, I would like to talk a little bit about this distinction. What does that mean to you, and why did you decide to work with any kind of a movie, and why is it important to talk about any kind of cinema movie in the landscape?
Well, it was just my favorite way to learn, in that I always found that I got most passionate about a subject if a movie introduced it to me. So, for example, I think like a lot of people, I only became passionate about Mozart because I saw Amadeus, and it's so good. Like, that movie is so powerful. I, you know, got interested in philosophy because of The Matrix. And so it's really just my favorite way to learn. I mean, because of Woody Allen movies, I got interested in Dostoevsky, you know. And so I just think that, you know, cinema has such a unique capability of being able to please us on a very sensory base level, while also having some real substance there that can kind of transition somebody who is only there for the spectacle and kind of transition them into also being curious about substance. And so I kind of wanted to give people the same bait and switch that really worked for me as a kid.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like, for example, when you, I'm sure, like, when you started your channel, at first, you know, YouTube has evolved so much during the years, and, like, now you see that a lot of people are looking for the clickbait, or maybe the title that would, like, you know, that that thing that they call the thumbnail, you know, that really attracts a lot of views nowadays, because everyone's just watching the first image that comes to mind, right? So I think, can you talk a little bit about, like, especially when you started on YouTube, how has that evolved as a platform for you? And how do you feel like all of the things that you've learned on YouTube now work on your new endeavor? Because, you know, YouTube at first, like I said, it was really different, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a really big question. And I think that the thing that you mentioned about thumbnails and needing to grab attraction, yes, it's true now, but it's been true pretty much since the beginning. I mean, it's always been like that. As far as the direction of YouTube, I had already kind of admitted in one of my early vlogs on my channel that, like, when I started the business of Wisecrack, I was making a bet that that YouTube industry would kind of go in a more premium direction, in the sense that, well, you know, if 500,000 people watch a small show on Comedy Central, and that show is able to command hundreds of thousands of dollars in advertising revenue based on one episode, I figured that why wouldn't digital media be able to do the same? And I was wrong, and there's a couple reasons why, but mostly the main reason is because the platforms, Google and Facebook, just literally took all the money. So I was very much wrong in that. And as a result, or maybe not because of that, but I don't know. It's hard to say. Influencers were given more money, maybe production budgets would be higher, but maybe not, because it's not necessary. Because what people are looking for when they're on the internet is parasocial relationships. They're looking for a friend. You know, this is in a lot of ways the digital friends industry. In terms of ways to play with the algorithm and things you got to do to keep YouTube happy so that your channel continues to grow, that shit will drive you fucking crazy. And I'm just not worried about it right now, to be honest, like, because it's constantly a game of second guessing yourself, of trying new things, of being obsessive about looking at the numbers like it's a ticker for that first hour so that the algorithm will put you in a more a better spot to get more suggested views. I mean, it's a nightmare. You know, that can like drive anyone crazy. So really, in terms of how that kind of the landscape of YouTube has informed my new venture, in terms of, you know, like growth hacking skills, I'm saying, fuck it, I don't care. In terms of what the content is going to be like, I'm trying to really recognize the platform for what it is. And it's basically a place that people develop friendships and relationships. Maybe it's a one-way relationship. Maybe it's more of like almost like people are subscribing to like a guru or a life coach or something like that. So really, I'm just trying to also just do it for fun. So I'm just trying to make content that seems fun to me or interesting to me. And really, I'm just letting that guide myself. I don't see this as like a project with a definitive financial goal or growth goal or anything like that. It's really just for fun.
That's great. I think we agree with you completely. Like, at least for us, our project is the same way. We both started that like that, like thinking, you know what, we don't care if 50 people listen to this or 5,000 or 500. It's just we want to be authentic to what we do, and we're not looking to, you know, to grab the numbers and to think about that, because you can go crazy, like you said. And my question was, I asked that question not to put you in the spotlight for YouTube, but just because sometimes Paco and I talk a lot about how cinema is becoming that thing as a commercial level. Like, sometimes the movies that we see now that are really, really popular feel like long, 2 hour long commercials or something that is like, oh, you have to have this here and that there. Or like they have like 8 people in a room being like, okay, so we need to add all of this. We need to tick all of these boxes in this movie. How can we do that? You know, and now sometimes cinema like really sins in that way, especially commercial cinema. And sometimes it feels kind of empty, kind of like really a marketing tool.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting time, definitely. I think that, unfortunately, one of the biggest reasons is that it's just expensive to make a movie. Yeah. And so in order to really justify the investment, and you have to create something that is going to appeal to the widest audience possible. The other thing that really scares me is the whole data-driven world that we live in. There was an article a couple of years ago about Cary Fukunaga when he was making the Netflix series Maniac. Was that him? Anyway, he mentioned that Netflix was giving him notes on the script, which is something that every studio does, but Netflix was giving him data points. So they said, hey, we should change this because we have data that suggests that 80% of people will stop watching if you keep this scene in there. How do you argue against that? You know, as an artist, you have no bargaining power because you can't counter that with data that you have.
Yeah.
Can you imagine, like, if somebody gave Werner Herzog that note, you know, Werner Herzog probably would have burned the building down.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Fuck you, I'm keeping my scene with iguanas that's 3 minutes long, even if people stop watching. And that's what it should be. That's what makes cinema exciting.
Yeah.
And I feel like we are moving into a place where artists will be pressured to make the quote unquote correct choice to please the most amount of people.
Yeah,
you're right. I agree. I think it was Frank Zappa a few years ago who said that the problem in the music industry was that that people who loved music were they were all substituted by executive people. And they know a lot about marketing, but they don't know about music. So that changed completely the landscape of producing a record. And I think it's the same for all arts, basically.
Yeah. I think also you're losing the art in the actual thing and the original ideas. Definitely, I think logarithmic art is going to destroy original ideas for sure.
Yeah. And what was I going to say?
Sorry.
Oh, I forgot. No, it's my fault. My brain is just mush. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Yeah, it's definitely like talking about like algorithms for sure. Like the music industry is going that way. Like I can see like all of my friends are musicians. Like I gather around a lot of musicians and a lot of them are talking about like just making music every 3 months just to please the Spotify algorithm, you know? Like it's the same way with Netflix algorithm. We're just talking different companies, but it's all the same. We're all just trying to, like they're just trying to get into certain playlists and like you're not thinking about like how can I express myself in the best way through this medium. It's just how can I please the matrix so it shows my content, you know, and I can actually make a living.
Yeah, I guess in this stage of my life, I'm trying to recognize the fact that, yeah, the most original thought and the most interesting art and the funniest art is not on the silver screen anymore.
Yeah.
The funniest thing that happened this year was on the medium of Reddit, and it was Wall Street Bets GameStop. It was the funniest thing that happened all year. Watching, yeah. Reading those comments, I mean, that's better than seeing, you know, Dumb and Dumber in the 90s. Like that's the closest we'll ever get to that again. You know, some Amazon reviews are fucking hilarious. Like, did you guys ever read like the Haribo sugarless gummy bears reviews? Like that's where cutting edge comedy is, in these new mediums that we don't think of as traditionally as entertainment, like on message boards, on product reviews, on YouTube. You know, YouTube gets a lot of shit for, you know, its ridiculous policies about silencing people. But at the end of the day, there's still some pretty crazy shit on YouTube and people are allowed to say quite a lot of things. Yeah. And I think that, again, the barrier to entry is non-existent. And so really, I think if you're looking for the most interesting, risky art, unfortunately, it's not in the form of a $1 million+ narrativized, you know, visual thing, which sucks for people like us who love that. But I don't know, maybe I just am trying not to become a boomer too quickly and try to embrace the new.
Yeah, it's hard. It's definitely hard. And it's interesting to think about, for example, the startup series like Rick and Morty and like certain kind of shows that just become like cult series that have start as original ideas, right? And they develop into like kind of like this massive media, because it's not just like in America, for example, in Latin America, Rick and Morty just became a thing, you know, like it's just huge.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting how like shows that talk about complex themes, you know, like and they're not as easy to understand, just become like a massive thing. Like what do you think about that? Like for me, it's always been really I've always been really curious about like those kinds of things that just become huge.
Phenomenal. You mean just like when things become a victim of their own success?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I mean, at the end of the day, boo fucking who, sorry, Justin Roiland is a gajillionaire now. But yeah, I mean, I hear you. I don't know. You know, to be honest, I haven't watched the newest season of Rick and Morty. I've seen like half of the episodes. But more than anything, I don't think that the show, I think that it's not that it's bad. It's still good. I think that I'm just kind of done with it because it's a show that I don't really think. I'm always looking for something with a strong perspective. And that's why I'm so drawn to South Park, because it's basically Trey's vision of the world in a form of comedy that I enjoy more. I'm not really into joke dense comedy where basically, you know, there's like a joke every 2 seconds. I'm much more into situational comedy where the joke is drawn out as a scene, like in South Park. So it's also just a matter of taste.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, South Park is huge in Latin America too.
Yeah. I have a friend who is Chilean and she was telling me about how, I mean, the American voices on South Park are great, but the, what do they call South Park Latino, the dubbed version? He said like those guys are great in their own way.
Yeah, actually, that has happened also with The Simpsons. We really love the Mexican voices, and those are the same voices that people hear in the rest of Latin America. So, yeah, they become their own things, even changing the jokes. You know, you didn't notice at first, but then you get used to it, and they change a lot of the jokes, but they still work.
Yeah, that's got to be a fun job.
Yeah,
for sure.
For sure. And what type of art are you excited about? Some kind of director right now, but especially young people or young creators that you can mention that you are excited about to see their work?
Filmmakers or anyone?
Anyone.
Anyone.
So in terms of filmmakers, I think really the only guy that is our age, I'm assuming that we're roughly the same age, but I could be wrong, but like that's our generation that I think made it in Hollywood as an auteur that I can think of is Ari Aster, the guy who made Midsommar and Hereditary. So I think both of those movies are really impressive. And so I'm interested to see where his career goes, because I think he could have, the dude might have a masterpiece in him. Jordan Peele, obviously, I think that his second movie, Us, is good, not great, but Get Out was such a home run.
Yes.
So yeah. I'm interested to see what he does. In terms of YouTubers, I find myself, there are some people on YouTube that are just savants. Like there's this guy, what is his name? He's in California. Harry Mack. He is a freestyle rapper.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if you guys have followed him.
Yeah, I've been watching videos. It's crazy.
Yeah, that guy is, he's the best in the world at what he does. Like no one can even get close. And the fact that someone like him has a platform like YouTube is great. That's what YouTube is made for. Freaks like him. Yeah. And so I also really like the comedian when it comes to, I've always been a big fan of like offensive comedy, quote unquote, like just pushing the limits of what can be said. And I think Long Beach Griffey is a YouTuber who I think is consistently funny. And I think he's a really good performer. So I really like his work. But yeah, I'm also in Finland now. So I'm currently kind of going through the work of some Finnish directors, because I'd never even seen a Finnish movie before moving here. And the Finnish Kubrick, his name is Kaarsmaki.
Yeah.
So I've seen two of his movies so far, and I might watch another one tonight.
Great. Which ones did you watch?
So I watched his first movie, Crime and Punishment, because Crime and Punishment is my favorite book. And so I'm always interested to see an adaptation. And it was a really interesting adaptation and a really good movie. And then I watched, I guess, what's probably his most famous movie that he made in 2011, Le Havre, which was also quite good.
Yeah, you should watch definitely the Leningrad Cowboys.
Cowboys?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to write that down.
There is even a cameo by Jim Jarmusch in the film, because they are very good friends.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, awesome. It's very cool. And actually, Kaarsmaki knows a lot about Mexican culture. I was surprised by that he even uses some Mexican music and things like that. That is why maybe he was very well known in Mexico during the 90s. That was
interesting.
We have a long-term love relationship with Kaarsmaki in Mexico. He's an awesome
director.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That's good to hear. Yeah. I mean, I'd honestly never even heard of him until like a month ago. So this is super exciting for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have interesting relationship between Kaarsmaki and Mexico. We have it's a long-standing relationship for sure.
Yeah, I think he doesn't know about it, but we love him in Mexico, really. Actually, and about Crime and Punishment, it's funny because he was telling once in one interview that one reporter asked him why did he decide to adapt Dostoevsky, and he went like, because people told me that it was impossible to adapt that novel. You wanted to prove that you're good enough to adapt it, and he was like, no. I was sure that I was going to make a shitty movie, so that released pressure for my second film.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It was really interesting how he kind of simultaneously was very strict about the adaptation in that, like, he kept all the main characters. Like, the love interest is kind of Raskolnikov's sister and Sonia in one character, but then they added like the Svidrigailov character and the Razumikin character. And it was like, okay, he knows the book well, and he's making some very strong, bold decisions in changing the story, but kind of works. You know, the greatest sin when you're adapting a classic novel is that you just stay too close to the novel and you realize that a novel is not a movie. And just because it works on in the text doesn't mean it's going to work on the screen. But then again, you know, you want to make all that money from the kids who rent it because they don't want to read the book, you know, so. Yeah. No.
That's real.
I can't imagine how much money To Kill a Mockingbird has made. Like, imagine how many kids.
Just from that, of course.
Yeah. Watching that movie.
Yeah, that's good. Also, you have to see his Shakespeare. He has a version of Hamlet in Business.
Cool. Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's amazing. Yeah. He's very good at adapting films. Hey, he's Paco, an awesome director.
Now that we're talking about Finnish directors, what other directors will you recommend Jared to watch? Because you probably watch a lot of them.
So I've only seen a handful. There's another movie that actually just came out in theaters. It was called The Potato Venture, and it was a comedy about this guy in the Middle Ages who, it's basically like startup humor. It's like a Silicon Valley startup, but the startup is growing potatoes. And it was pretty funny. I don't know who directed it, but I'm still at the very beginning, so I don't really have other recommendations make.
I was telling Paco to recommend you something.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry.
No. No, or let me think about it, because I also thought you were asking Jared, actually. Let me think about it, and I will for sure. Because actually, a good friend of mine lived there, and she came with a lot of films from and DVDs from Finland.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
We have I have a friend from Holland, and sometimes we get confused because her English is her second language too. So sometimes we made this joke that we always understand each other 80%. So we want to keep 80%, like in Interstellar, it's like 80%. You know, they say 90% there, but it was like we just have that 80% and the 20% left is just joke. You know, because every time we joke, because sometimes we can't understand what each other is saying or what each other is meaning, but it's really, really funny.
I'm dating a Turkish girl right now, and we have the same thing.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Actually, I wanted to ask you that. How have it been for you to arrive to a country with a different language and with a completely different sense of relationship? How have you managed to change? Yeah.
Well, I'm still at the very beginning. I've only been here for 2.5 months. Wow. But yeah, it's a bit challenging. I mean, I'm very fortunate that the business language for at least the company I work with and probably the entire industry in Helsinki is English. So that's been very easy. But yeah, the street signs, it's very rare that you see English because it's only Finnish and Swedish. But it's a small enough place and most people do speak English. And I, you know, once you kind of learn your way around, I mean, I learned my way around Beijing, not really knowing that much Chinese. So this is a little bit easier, especially since most people do speak English. Mm-hmm. So it hasn't really been. And I think because of my experience in China, I probably wasn't that concerned about being here. So yeah, it has honestly, really the answer is most people speak English, so it's not that bad. I'm very privileged that I speak in you know, like the international business language.
That's true. I remember a lot of my friends moved to Spain, and because I did my postgraduate studies here, and a lot of them couldn't speak Spanish, and in Spain, not a lot of people speak English, so it was really hard for them to grasp the culture and like everything, because it was just like they will force you to learn Spanish because no one speaks English.
Yeah, I've heard that people in Finland are a little bit insular and that it can be hard to make friends, but I haven't really had an issue, to be honest. The people I work at a very large company, so people are very inviting, and it's been nice.
Good. Now, changing a little bit the topic, but you have talked a lot about that in your new channel, well, twice, actually. One time specifically with the subject and in recent days about Dave Chappelle. But Let's talk a little bit about how do you feel with this idea of cancel culture and how it changed the landscape on ideas, on critical discussions, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the real, I don't know, the big, my big soapbox thing at the moment is I think that too many people have bound up the ideas of what is funny and what is morally correct. And I think that that's a big mistake because, first of all, I just don't think it's true. And I think that it's a real harmful, maybe harmful is not the right word, but it's a very sad thing when people feel like that they can only laugh at things that pass a certain ideological purity test. Because I think that, you know, it's funny. I'm sure, Francisco, maybe not a fan, but at least you're aware of Slavoj Žižek. And I heard him say something recently. Yeah. He said something recently about how, you know, all of these kind of academic liberals love to say that Freud is no longer relevant, but everything that's happening today only reinforces the fact that we need to reintroduce Freud, because there is this fantasy that people have that the unconscious doesn't even exist. Like, we are always completely in control of our meaning. We are completely in control of our desires, and we are completely aware of them. And that is such a ridiculous notion, first of all. And I think that people like Freud needs to be reintroduced to comedy. We need to understand that what's funny is not necessarily, like, there's no logical explanation for why people find some things funny. And the more that we try to, you know, fit some sort of moral rubric over what is funny and what isn't, then you're going to kill the idea of comedy entirely. That's like asking somebody to, like, you know, choose their sexual desires or what makes them, you know, what turns them on from some sort of like morally accepted rubric. Like, yeah, obviously it just doesn't work that way. There is a thing called the unconscious. There is libido. And that also has to do with what you find funny.
Yeah,
for sure. I remember I was reading an article about, I don't know if you like the series The Office. And I was reading this article about how The Office has recently been really popular with young people, even though it just ended like ages ago. And it's really, really getting popular with young people. And this person was arguing that it's because a lot of the humor in The Office is not politically correct for now. Like, a lot of the humor that especially Michael Scott manages in some of the parts of The Office is not kind of like politically correct sometimes. So a lot of young people feel that the series lets them laugh at some things that maybe now they're not as correct. And also, I think that's why South Park is as popular as ever right now, because it also provides like this window of opportunity to laugh at things that a lot of people will not laugh about. Like, the last couple of episodes have been about the pandemic, you know, and they're hilarious. And it's just they are the only ones that are like maybe brave enough or just crazy enough to say, you know what, fuck it, we're just gonna do anything and we're just gonna say whatever we want, like Dave Chappelle, right?
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, good. Yeah, I was thinking about how this has changed not only the landscape in comedy, but also in other fields, you know, like trying to make this image of purity about art and about everything else, as you well said, quoting Žižek. Yeah, also the desires and the sexual expressions are changing, but towards a more conservative point of view. I don't know exactly how to call it in English. I'm struggling to have the right word. But yeah, we are in the presence of a big change about these sort of ideas, and not in a very positive way, as always.
Yeah, like last week there was an LA Times article, and it was like a solidarity fist in the air, and then it said comedy, like socialism's new tool or something like that. And, you know, you could be, I mean, I have tendencies towards certain socialist programs and initiatives, but I certainly don't think we're going to get there with comedy, because it's not going to be funny. It's just going to be propaganda.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah,
that's also a thing. Like, especially especially here in Spain, for example, my experience living here is everything gets politicized really, really hard. So, like, sometimes you want to talk about something, and in the end, it just ends up being on one side or another, you know. And it's really hard to try to express complex ideas or try to develop complex concepts without people labeling them as such or such. I think sometimes, like, especially now, I think it's really hard to make people understand that it's not 0 or 100, it's not black or white. Like, the most interesting ideas will make you think about the grayscale of things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's hard, especially right now with what we're living in the world, with all the political agenda that we have one side and another. But I think it's interesting that for example, with Dave Chappelle, like, I watched that special. I actually just watched it, and I arrived late to a meeting because I was watching it and I couldn't stop watching. It was just so, so interesting, especially for me that I'm not American, just seeing how he crafts his humor and everything around it. I was really, really impressed. Like, I think he's reaching a certain level of maturity in his comedy that it's just genius. At least for me. And
I 100% agree. I 100% agree. And I also think that I've seen a lot of people criticize him in saying that, oh yeah, he's so funny. He's telling jokes about pedophile priests. I made those jokes when I was 16. And again, these people they don't understand. They think that comedy is like a Rick and Morty script where it's just coming up with the most clever turn of phrase. It's not. Comedy is like being a preacher. It's like being Tony Robbins. When I say that Dave Chappelle knows how to work a room, he knows how to set a tone and to make everybody in the audience be like captured by his voice. He basically almost like establishes a cult of personality in that room to where he could say very simple juvenile things. But because everyone in that room is so acutely aware of the nuance of his meaning, it's hilarious. And I think that, again, people just evaluate his ability as a comedian as saying like, oh, you know, climaxing in a priest's face is not original, therefore it's not funny. They don't get it. They think that comedy is too simple. And honestly, everyone in Hollywood thinks that too, because you see Hollywood comedic writers and it's literally just like, who can write the shit that's so clever you can almost imagine the writer patting themselves on the back as they write it, which is all I think about when I watch Rick and Morty.
Yeah. I think it will be cool to see how this ages. Like, I think let's see how this survives the test of time. And like, as time goes on and we have a photograph of what's going on right now, we will probably appreciate it in a different way.
My opinion is it's going to be woke-sploitation. Similar to how we look at blaxploitation films, we're going to look back at this series of comedy and just be like, we'll laugh at it, I hope. That's my very optimistic standpoint.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, what kind of philosophy are you reading now? Which authors you feel enthusiastic about right now?
Yeah, so I had the book. Okay, so here I have some books. So this is the last book that I finished. It's called The Divide by Jason Hickel. This is more of an economics text. This is about global inequality and about how kind of the Global Development Project is a bunch of bullshit and how poverty numbers are severely underreported. And basically how the divide between rich country and poor country came about. I really recommend it. It's a pretty fascinating read. The book that I'm reading right now is, I thought it was on my desk, but it's not. Oh yeah, no, it is. Okay, sorry. It is this, The Spiral of Silence by Elizabeth Noel Newman. Really recommend this. I think it's extremely extremely relevant today. Right now, I'm in a part of the book where she's kind of going through a survey of the various philosophies of public opinion. I just got through the section on John Locke, which is his basically public opinion is fashion. And this idea of fashion, John Locke was obsessed with. And I think it is quite profound. And I think that hidden in this concept of fashion is also something about comedy that people don't realize. And that is that comedy is like fashion. It is not a line of progress. People in the comment section of my Chappelle video seem to think that, you know, it's like a linear progress of history where slapstick was once funny, but now we've evolved past that and it's no longer funny. No, no, no. That's like saying red was in last season, but we've evolved past that. And now we realize that blue is actually what's, you know, what's in. No, it's just fashion. It is the like kind of ebb and flow of what resonates with people. And there is no greater, you know, advancement per se. It's literally just what is in vogue now versus later. That's it. No more values, no more value judgment than that.
Yeah, I think also it's cool to see, for example, we had an episode about like why Avengers movies and like superhero movies are so popular right now. And we were talking about like how a lot of these movies are in fashion just because what's happening in the world, you know, like a lot of the things that happen in the world just inform what people are interested in, you know, and that's the thing. We, like you said, we think that some stuff is just going to be like, okay, we moved past that. We understood that. We like that. Let's just make the next thing. But fashion does, like you said, it doesn't work like that. It just comes and goes and it just picks up certain things depending on like the social and cultural context of our time, and it develops them, right? And it just puts forward the best and the worst of it.
Right. And these people who suggest that, you know, this is funny and that isn't funny, I mean, they act as if they have this, it's a very kind of religious tendency to suggest that they have this meta narrative of how comedy progresses and they understand it completely and they can, you know, denote this is not funny because, I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree. But actually, I think we are living in this time that happens a lot, you know, like saying, because now we are this, it's no longer allowed to be this or to laugh at this or to watch this type of films. Because, of course, a film age and sometimes don't age well. They don't share the points of view we have right now in the world. But that doesn't mean that this is wrong to watch that film. And I think we are trying to, or when we're not trying to, we are confusing, acknowledging that the world has changed to actually censoring some ideas because they are not the same ideas we have right now.
Yeah, 100% agree. And there's just a real failure to understand context. It blew my mind when at the University of Southern California, they took down a statue of John Wayne because he was racist. Give me a break. This was in the fucking 1940s. Literally everyone was racist. The only thing you can really say about John Wayne is that he was famous at that point.
Yeah. We talked about this a lot. Like, if you don't contextualize art, you're just going to be a slave of your own judgment, especially if you're like reading something or watching something that is not of your era. Like, it's maybe 50s, 60s. A lot of the stuff, like, if you judged someone just on like one side of their personality or works or things, it's really
hard. I think especially they work as scapegoats, you know, like because they are racist, we are not. It's like not to acknowledge that that we are systemically part of this. We have to change the whole system, a whole point of view that made us be what we are. Not only think that eliminating this kind of fears, we are eliminating the problem. Actually, we have seen that it's the opposite.
Yeah, there seems to be this thing where people pathologically need to be assured that they are a good person. Hmm. And I feel like if you're too sure about that, then I get scared because then... And that's another thing. I think that people like to pretend that their imagination is limited in the sense that, oh, I can't even imagine some of the horrible, you know, racist things that you could say. Therefore, I can't be racist because my imagination doesn't even go to those places. I'm very skeptical of those people. And I also think it's just a bad fashion statement to wear in a sense, because I think that I actually would rather be with somebody who can imagine horrible things, because then that person is aware when he's enacting them, rather than somebody who claims to or actually does have a very limited imagination and who may not even be aware that they're doing horrible things that they can't imagine.
Yeah, yeah. For sure. And I don't know if you've watched the work of Mike Flanagan, like as we were talking about.
Only this. Dr. Sleep.
Oh, okay. Well, he's made a couple of like miniseries on Netflix, like The Haunting of Hill House, and now he made a miniseries called Midnight Mass that is really popular right now. And this Midnight Mass has a character that it's exactly what you're talking about. Like this character needs to be reassured that she's a good person. Like she's always like, she needs to be reassured that she's a good, she's like a really religious devout. She's like a terrible person, but she just needs to have that reassurance. And it's really interesting. I will recommend you to watch this miniseries. Maybe you'll like it. And it talks a lot about that, like especially now that about religion and how we perceive, how we need the approval of others, even though we don't have the approval, that we know that we are deep down not the best person.
Yeah. Well, what's it called again? I'm going to write it down.
Midnight Mass.
Midnight Mass. I like Michael Flanagan. Yeah.
Yeah, he's really good.
I think he's quite interesting. Yeah. Yeah, but well, now we would like to know. For the people in Mexico, the people in Spain, especially who listen to the podcast, how can we expect from your new channel? While you talk at the beginning of the interview, that you are trying to do what you feel the need to do, but what can we expect about this new channel and this new project from Jared Bauer?
Well, what would you like to see? Because really, I'm coming up with videos like, you know, every week, I'm just like, oh, I'll do that. And then I have no idea what I'm doing the week after. Like, there really is not much of a plan. So I don't really know how to answer that. I mean, I'd like to interview more people. There, like, for example, this guy, Jason Hickel, I reached out to, haven't heard back from him, but I would like to interview people. I know a guy who was a very famous writer in LA who got canceled. And I want to interview him about his cancellation. Those are all just things that I haven't gotten a chance to schedule yet. I don't think I'm going to be doing any like, you know, official like productions. Like I probably won't be creating shows like Thug Notes or Earthling Cinema again. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it's probably more vlogs, maybe more kind of philosophy. I mean, I will do video essays, probably just not very many because like, you know, for example, I have like a whole South Park idea, but I have to finish this book first. And, you know, I have a new career now in a new industry and I'm just really excited to be learning about a new industry. And so, you know, most of my energy is going towards that.
I think I'm really hopeful and happy that that you're doing this right now and feels really fresh. And I think maybe this will be a good point to have a really great relationship with this kind of things in your life. For example, for me, sometimes when I was doing when I was in the commercial side of music, sometimes it felt kind of like a toxic relationship where I had to do something all the time, and just having the time in your life to have a healthy relationship with stuff that you love and just going back to it and be like, why do I like to do this? Right. And I think it's really respectful and I'm very happy that this is happening. And I'm really enjoying your new content and how it's progressing. And I feel like it comes from an honest part of yourself. And I really enjoy that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I mean, I appreciate you saying that. That is the top priority is authenticity. And yeah, I forgot what I was going to say. Sorry, guys.
No worries. No worries. No, but for the people, for the audience in Mexico, wherever you are, I think that's what's really interesting about this channel of the work that Jared does. I was the day you released a video of your wall. It was amazing how just by looking at a picture, we are having thought, not only sharing who you are, but talking about why these authors, why these people are important. And you're talking a lot about the landscape in our culture right now. And I think that's what I'm excited about, not only these channels, but the things are happening right now that we can share thought. Most of all, not only entertainment, but thought.
Yeah, and I really think that authenticity is something that I want to spread, because I think that a lot of people, and look, I'm not saying that I'm like a blank slate of a human being and I am the most authentic person ever and I have no biases. Everything that I do is just purely spontaneous. Obviously, I'm not saying that. But I do think that some people don't know that they have an option to be themselves.
Yes.
And for example, like this whole thing with comedy that I'm going on and on about with this Dave Chappelle thing, like you have the right, and it's okay, and it's not a bad reflection on you if you laugh at something that you don't agree with. I mean, God, you know, like that's another thing that's kind of sad about today. People will say that, oh, I have never laughed at a racist joke in my life. Please, you know, please, really? I mean, it's crazy. And yeah, like, for example, the people on my wall, you know, I didn't want to be like the Great Gatsby and have a bookshelf full of books that he never read, you know? So like, of course, when I was picking this wall, I was like, you know, I don't have any representation of the trans community and I only have one black woman on here, you know, like, but at the end of the day, I'm like, fuck that. I'm not going to tokenize these people and put them on my wall, even though I don't know anything about their work.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good. And that's really authentic of you. Because I also believe that now with Instagram and with all those social media, a lot of people try to like zero into intellectualize things and be like, oh, I know about this or I know about that. I know this name, where they haven't even read or listened to that artist or anything. And it's like, I don't care if you say you know all of these things. Like the best thing is for you to experience that cinema or that art or that music and just make it yours. Right, like in the end, it's like how do you make those experiences yours, and how do you share that with people?
Yeah, this is another thing that scares me, is that people don't only just adopt someone else's opinion, but they adopt opinions that they don't even understand. People have beliefs that they can't even express, in the sense that, like, even in my Dave Chappelle video, I had at least, you know, a lot of people saying, oh, you got to watch ContraPoints, but no one was able to say what the video is about or what her opinion is, what their opinion is. It's almost as if other people's opinions are basically just filler for what people feel like, or not filler, but, you know, it's rather than the actual substance of the opinion.
Yeah, superficial expression.
It's a superficial expression. It's also just a sense of relief or a sense of, you know, oh, okay, there is an opinion out there that can be expressed by somebody that affirms my feelings. I'm just going to point to them, and that is going to basically be my, you know, that is my opinion, whatever they say. Now I am convinced that I am a good person because I have an opinion on this matter, and it is the correct opinion because this person I trust on the internet has said something that sounds smart. Don't remember what it was exactly, but that's what I believe.
That is something that I'm really afraid of, you know, like managing the world of ideas, world thought, as it was world beliefs. You know, like things that we believe in, instead of criticizing these things and where do they come. This is really important to know, not only the context, but to think critically about what we are right now.
And I've spoken to three people recently who have all had a very strong opinion about J.K. Rowling and said that J.K. Rowling is a bad person. And I said, what did she say that made you have such a strong feeling? And nobody was able to give me a quote, and didn't even have to be an exact quote. Just roughly, what does she believe? Fill in the blank. And I'm not saying that some people can't do it. I'm sure some people can do it, but not enough. It should be everyone. You need to know what you believe.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, that's right. Sure. Well, but I think we are reaching the end, but any more thoughts that you want to share with us, especially taking into account that we are talking to countries that maybe you are not very used to? You have a collaboration with a Mexican guy, I think, recently.
Oh yeah, Diego Rosar, and well, he's Brazilian, yeah. But he lives in Mexico.
He's Brazilian, yeah, he lives in Mexico. That's right. It was very interesting, but I don't know if you want to say something to resume what the interview or what you want to share with us, with the audience.
Well, I would say if you speak English again, mi español es no bueno. So you're going to have, if you speak English, love to have you on my channel at youtube.com/Jared Bauer, Bauer. Would love any requests from you guys. As far as everybody listening in Mexico, don't come to Finland expecting good Mexican food. You're not going to find it.
nor is Spain, actually.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I didn't realize how spoiled I was. I mean, Tex-Mex, Cali-Mex. And then my favorite place in L.A. was this Oaxacan place. Oh, so good.
Yeah.
A lot of salmon. A lot of salmon here, and I like salmon, but man.
I
need a taste of home.
If someday you will come to Barcelona, we can make enchiladas and things like that are not even Tex-Mex. So yeah, another kind of Mexican food.
Yes, and I will bring you gentlemen Taco Bell from my country. We have quesalupas and crunch wraps. Together.
you're thoroughly invited to Spain whenever you want to come. You're invited. You can enjoy.
Oh, great! So both of you guys are in Barcelona.
I'm living in the Canary Islands, actually. So I live
okay,
in
cool.
Tenerife, but sometimes I go to Barcelona. So for sure, Barcelona will be easier because it's definitely closer. But
well, same thing with the Nordics, man. Come on down.
Yes, thank
great,
you. Thank
great,
you.
We will, and I hope we can have more collaborations with you. This has been
absolutely
a pleasure.
As I said, I'm doing this for fun, and this has been fun, so I'm more than happy to keep doing it.
Yes,
we are planning to analyze with some friends some movies, so that maybe could be fun.
Oh, cool. Well, yeah, I will tell you about something coming up soon. I'm going to announce that. Me and actually Diego's brother, Mateus, who is a philosophy teacher, mm-hmm. we're going to test out doing live viewings and analyses of movies over Zoom.
Oh,
so we're
right.
going to try it. We're going to try it. We're going to start out with the 1968 movie Network. Ooh, so good.
Great. Wow.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. So I'll let you guys know when that's happening.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, and of course, we will let know our audience about that too.
Yes,
cool.
You heard it first here. Now you know.
That's right. That's right. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for inviting me. This was fun.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was really fun, Jared.